This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm Oliver Wiseman, editor of CapEx and Free Exchange host. This week, we're tackling one of the most important economic trends in recent history. When we think about the economy, we tend to think about stuff. Goods are manufactured and sold. Factories are built and upgraded. Innovation gives us shiny new gadgets we can hold in our hands. But this is becoming a less and less accurate way of thinking about things. Increasingly, intangible assets are what matter. According to Jonathan Haskell and Stian Westlake, the authors of the brilliant Capitalism Without Capital, these intangible assets don't play by the basic laws of economics. And so the rise of assets you can't touch, they argue, is having a big impact on how the economy works. Haskell and Westlake start with a simple, even obvious insight, and end with an important and thoughtful book about the nature of the modern economy. Their work has received high praise from high places. Bill Gates, for example, calls Capitalism Without Capital required reading for policymakers. For this week's episode of Free Exchange, I spoke to Stian Westlake about his book, which is out now in paperback, and the implications of the ideas contained within it. I started by asking him to outline his basic thesis.
So, me and my co-author, Jonathan Haskell of Imperial College, had for quite a while been asking ourselves the question, what's really going on in the economy? When you heard people, when you heard economists, policymakers talking about innovation, talking about economic growth, they'd very often talk about things that seem to refer to the world of manufacturing. So they talk about, you know, this is how many cars we're making, this is how many patents we're filing, this is how much R&D we're doing, which is something that tends to be concentrated in the manufacturing sector. And we just thought, this doesn't seem to bear much reflection to the world that we know, the kind of jobs that people we know do, the jobs that most people who work in the UK do. We have a service-dominated industry, a service-dominated economy. People tend to work as much with their minds or in the service sector as other areas. And we thought, this just doesn't resonate with what's going on. And Jonathan had been working for some time on a way of measuring capital that looked more at how the economy worked today. So rather than thinking about just factories or buildings or machines, he was thinking about the types of capital that you can't see or touch. So the ideas that arise from R&D, the brands that arise from marketing, the supply chains and organizational structures that arise from kind of what people do in offices on a day-to-day basis. And if you think about the modern economy, those are the things, for the most part, that give businesses and give industries their durable value. And so we said, well, goodness me, let's look at how this can be measured, something that Jonathan had been working on and other economists have been working on for a while. And then we thought, well, you know, what are the implications of this? And really what the book was based on is, firstly, a desire to explain this change in the economy, this move from things you can see and touch to things that you can't see and touch, but also to say, how might this explain some big changes in the economy that people seem to be worried about now?
And for this to be a phenomenon worth writing a book about, there have to be differences between tangible and intangible capital beyond just the fact you can't touch it. So what makes intangible capital kind of interesting, distinct from old-fashioned sort of factories and things like that?
Well, we think there's a few really important economic differences between the way intangible capital works and tangible capital works, which is kind of what accounts for all these changes. And in good authorial style, we've kind of got, we've given them a framework. We've called this the 4S framework, because there are four of them and they all begin with S. So if I might go through them. The first way that intangibles are different is they're scalable. That's the first S. So if you imagine, let's talk about minicabs. If you think of a minicab company like Addison Lee in London, every time they want to take a bunch more passengers, they need another cab. So the vehicles, their tangible capital, doesn't really scale. You need to buy more if you want to do more business. Mm. But then if you think of Uber or Lyft, if you think of a company that's perhaps more based on intangible capital, their intangible capital is their algorithms and their software. Now, those things are scalable. So Uber can more or less transfer their algorithm to a new city. If they double the number of rides they take in a month, the algorithm will more or less scale without significant further investment. And we notice that intangible capital tends to have this scalable characteristic. That's the first thing. The second characteristic is spillovers. That's our second S. And what that means in economic jargon is if you run a business and you invest in some intangibles, let's say you do some R&D and come up with a fantastic new technology for a new product, it's quite hard to be certain that your business is going to get the exclusive benefit of that idea, or even that you'll get any of the benefit of that idea. And, you know, there are all these wonderful stories like how the British conglomerate EMI invented the CT scanner, this kind of incredible medical breakthrough back in the 1960s. But EMI and EMI's shareholders saw virtually none of the money from this fantastic invention, because it turned out that General Electric and Siemens in Germany almost immediately came in, designed their own version of the product, inspired by EMI, and cornered the market. And that's a kind of classic example of the spillovers, at work. The third S is sunkenness, and economists out there will be aware of this idea of sunk costs, costs that are kind of hard to recover if a business fails. And intangible investments are very often sunk costs in a way that tangible investments aren't. So an interesting example, if you think of Monarch Airlines, the UK low-cost carrier that not all that long ago went bust, Monarch Airlines had a bunch of tangible assets and a bunch of intangible assets. The tangible assets were the planes they had. The intangible assets were things like their landing slots and their brand. The planes, as soon as Monarch went bust, were immediately sent off to other leasing companies, and some of them were flying again very quickly. Those were not sunk costs. They were very easy to recycle in the case of bankruptcy. The landing slots, it turns out, there were months and months of legal wrangling about not even what should happen to these landing slots, but even who owned them. Did Monarch really own them? Should they be reassigned? So there's a lot of doubt about who owns these things, and in some cases, as with brand, the brand was almost worthless once the company went bust. So these intangibles tend to be sunk costs. And then the final S is synergies. And the point about synergies is that intangible assets are unusually good when you combine them with other intangible assets. And one great example of that is the iPhone. I have an iPhone sitting on the desk in front of me here. It's, you know, arguably one of the most profitable consumer products ever created. But it's kind of a mixture of quite a lot of different intangible assets. That's why it's so good. So there's a bunch of technologies in the iPhone. But actually, you know, those technologies are more or less available to anyone making smartphones back in 2007, 2008 when the iPhone came out. There's no reason why the iPhone should be any better than these kind of weird Nokia things that we never talk about anymore. There was the design. When people talk about how wonderful Sir Johnny Ive is, he designed this kind of amazing form factor that was very intuitive to use. We also think about there are these business assets, the fact that the App Store was developed, which allowed so many apps to be developed. That's a significant intangible asset. And finally, the marketing operation. So the way that Apple created a channel so that the mobile phone operators would give you basically a cheap iPhone. All of those things are assets. They're durable things that the business gets a long-term benefit from. But it was the combination of those that created this multi-billion dollar product, because we know that people who had just one of them, they were much less valuable. And again, with tangible assets that are fungible, you see that effect much less. So our four S's basically mean that an intangible economy will behave in interestingly different ways to a tangible-based economy.
And I guess the next obvious question is where we are in the on the tangible to intangible curve? You know, is this something you have spotted, a new trend in the economy that we're just seeing the benefits of, or not the benefits necessarily, but the consequences of, or are we, has it already happened? You know, where are we?
So one of the things we do in the book is we look at the data over time. And it turns out, and my co-author has done quite a lot of the empirical work on this along with others, it turns out that intangible investment is a very steady, long-term growing trend. Probably, if you look at, say, the US or the UK, it was about a decade ago or so that intangible investment exceeded tangible investment. So about 10 years ago, UK and US businesses started doing more intangible investment each year than they're doing tangible investment. Countries like France and Germany a little bit slower to catch up. Countries like Scandinavia maybe a little bit ahead of us. But if you look at rich world countries now, pretty much all of them, any given year, there'll be more intangible investment than tangible. But what's really interesting, if you look at this phenomenon, it's a very long-term phenomenon. So you can trace the rise of intangibles back to, in some cases, data sets from the 1940s and 1950s. And it's one of those very satisfying lines when you look at it on a chart. It's basically an arrow going more or less smoothly straight up over time.
Right. You know, I guess one of the responses to your book might be that this is not as exciting on you as you claim. And you could say, I mean, this is just purely to play devil's advocate, but you could say that if you were making the best violins in the world in the 16th century, like the, and compare that to the iPhone, they were something that, you know, everyone had the technology and tools needed to make them, and a forest nearby to, you know, collect whatever. But you had a reputation, a sort of basic kind of advertising thing going on probably, and lots of the things that you kind of identify in, say, an iPhone.
I think that's a really good challenge, and I think it really highlights what is unusual or what's special about this phenomenon. So you're absolutely right. There have always been intangible investments. There have always been brands. There have always been new ideas. But what's significant now is the quantity. So it's this fact that now a greater percentage of investment that business makes is intangible than tangible. So yes, as we're saying, there was R&D in the 1960s, there was R&D in the 1940s, there's R&D in the 19th century. What's significant now is how much of the total annual flow of investment is represented by intangible investments like that. And one of the consequences of that, because this is a gradual change, this isn't like sort of one year there wasn't blockchain and then someone started using blockchain. This is much more of a gradual change. It means that we think this is a plausible explanation for some of these long-term phenomena that have been growing in the economy.
Right, and let's move on to that. And just as a way into that, I think it's worth pointing out that what you've just said means this is not, even though it's tempting to look at the title of your book and kind of probably lots of the write-ups about it and stuff, and to think, this is a book about Google and Facebook and Apple, which it is, but it's actually about the whole economy, right? I mean, the point is, this is not a book about just about Silicon Valley or...
That's absolutely right. And one story we tell in the book is we look at quite a lot, not just of tech businesses, but of very, the absolute opposite, very non-tech businesses, very physical businesses. And one of the examples I particularly like is the example of the gym industry.
Right.
So the gym industry, you think, is like the least intangible industry there is. It's very
actual,
physical. It's
literal weights.
It's about lifting weights.
Yeah.
Physical appearances. And it's interesting, if you look at, say, an early gym, if you look at the kind of, the classic early gym was Gold's Gym, which was what Arnold Schwarzenegger's 1977 movie Pumping Iron was based on. That was largely a physical business. There were weights, there were weight machines, there was a building.
Real estate, and,
real estate, those were tangible assets. There was a brand, but the brand wasn't worth very much because initially there was only one Gold's Gym. If you look at a gym nowadays, there are kind of two interesting differences. The first thing is, if you go to a local branch of LA Fitness or whatever you're a member of, you'll see there'll be lots of intangibles that may be quite hard to see. So there'll be software systems that will track names. There's a very complex marketing operation, because obviously the way to make money in gyms is to get people to join your gym and never come, which they think quite hard about. There'll be operating processes that are often proprietary where people are trained, which you wouldn't have had back in the 1970s. But then the really interesting thing, the second aspect, is there are now some of the most profitable businesses in the gym industries are almost totally intangible. So if any of you have done a body pump class or any of these high intensity interval training classes, Body Pump is run by a company called Les Mills, based in the South Island of New Zealand. What Les Mills does, I mean, they do have a few tangible assets, they have a studio in New Zealand, but basically what they do is they secure music rights to the soundtracks for workout videos, they design workout routines, and they have a distribution network where they send these videos and instructions out to gyms all around the world that are licensees, and they make an awful lot of money out of doing this. So you see this world where once upon a time, this very physical business, the business of literally pumping iron, has changed into a business that is just totally shot through with these intangibles, whether they are kind of research or music rights or organizational structures.
And let's move on then to these big economic trends that you guys think are at least partly explained by the phenomenon you're describing, which are sort of, to put it, I think the quickest way of putting it would be both the kind of secular stagnation, so slowing growth rates, and by my count, maybe two kinds of inequality, one between income inequality between people, and the other is between firms, and you have these winner-take-all firms, and everyone gets left in the dust. So there's obviously a lot in there.
Yeah. Well, should we maybe talk about inequality first?
Yes, stagnation afterwards.
So I think when it comes to inequality, obviously we're in a period where inequality is at quite a high level. It rose quite sharply since the 80s. It's been somewhat flat, but at quite a high plateau in the last decade or so. We think, I mean, first...
You're going to come back to your four S's again, aren't you? Something tells me that.
Eventually will. Obviously, it goes without saying that that is quite similar to the period in which intangible investment has been increasing. But I think there are a couple of interesting mechanisms going on here. The first of which is that what we've also seen over that period is a peeling apart between the most productive and profitable businesses in any given industry or country and the rest. This is something that the OECD have done a lot of work on, and that has been quite linked to the rise of income inequality as well. There's some great work by Song and Bloom in the US who've used census data, and they basically showed you can explain a lot of the rise of income inequality, not by the increase in wage differentials between, say, CEOs and janitors, but by just the fact that CEOs in Google are earning much more than CEOs,
right,
and the also-ran firms, and the janitors who work for those firms are earning more, and so forth. So this gap between the leader and the laggard firms explains a big chunk of the income inequality. And what we would argue, this is there's a big debate going on about why this gap has increased. We think you can boil this down to intangibles. And in fact, since we wrote, in the book we do some the back of the envelope analysis, which suggests that actually these leader firms are the ones that have valuable intangibles. And we've been thrilled that since we wrote the book, some more careful empirical people have done some more detailed work that shows that that is almost certainly true. So it's these intangibles, given that they're scalable. So if you have a big successful business like Google, your valuable intangibles go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And because they have synergies, if you were, again, Google or Facebook, the benefit of investing in an additional intangible asset is all the higher because you can combine them with things you've already got.
Right.
So in that world of where capital is more scalable, where capital has more synergies between them, you would expect to see leader firms rising and the rest stagnating. So that's one explanation that helps explain some of the rise of income inequality. We've also got this question of wealth inequality, what Thomas Piketty talked about in his rightly famous book. And of course, one of the your readers will no doubt know that one of the interesting critiques or analyses of Piketty pointed out that a lot of the rise of wealth inequality that Piketty observed was actually driven by property prices.
Yes.
And this is not just any property prices. We all know that the prices of the property that's become particularly valuable is property in the world's thriving cities, prime real estate. And one of the ironic consequences of the rise of intangible capital, because it has spillovers and because it has synergies, because there are very high rewards to bringing these ideas together, it means that the places where people bring these ideas together, whether that's Silicon Valley or Shoreditch or Cambridge or Tel Aviv, that those places become particularly desirable. And those are indeed the places where we've seen property prices rise most sharply, exacerbated no doubt by things like zero interest rate policies. Mm-hmm. But you know, the reason why it's happened in those places, mm-hmm, is because of this intangible economy. So if you buy this argument that a lot of what Piketty's observing is driven by this very tangible asset of property, that's the one tangible asset that is dependent on intangibles. It's based, mm-hmm, on clusters of knowledge coming together. So that's another area in which this big change in the economy has driven inequality.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And just on that point, there's a sort of one of the reasons it's such an interesting argument in your book is it's a very counterintuitive point, actually both the points you just made, because while the thing we were always told about tech, basically intangible investment, was this meant that barriers to entry vanished, and anyone could be the next, yesterday's startups are today's the biggest companies in the world today. And so there was this idea of kind of this kind of investment opening up opportunities to people. And it's sort of, that is true, but it's also true that it has this kind of winner takes all effect.
I think this is one of the most interesting dynamics going on in the world economy at the moment. And there's a real mystery here. We don't know how this is going to play out. Because, as you say, there is a big winner-takes-all effect. If you're Google, if you're Facebook, if you're Uber, you're doing extremely well. The flip side of that, to come back to the four S's, relates to the spillovers and the scalability. Mm-hmm. Because the other thing that we know is these ideas tend to slip away from businesses in a way that, you know, if you own a big steel mill, only you can use your steel mill, mm-hmm, no one else can use your steel mill. But if you invent the search engine, or if you're Yahoo with a very successful search engine business in the early 2000s, it was pretty easy for Google to accept the idea of search engine, and they got some spillovers from US government-funded research and from academic, mm-hmm, research. And because of scalability, because these businesses can go from 0 to 60 very quickly, as it were, Google went from being this kind of tiny business that looked like an insignificant competitor to a giant like Yahoo, to being absolutely dominant, and who talks about Yahoo anymore?
Right.
So that's the dynamic. Which of those two forces will dominate? Some of your listeners may remember the antitrust hearings that first of all Microsoft and more recently Google have gone through. And one of the defences that these firms used before the European Commission in the US was to say, well, you know, we may look like Goliath now, but if you look back at the history of IBM or Microsoft talked about, sorry, Google talked about the history of Microsoft, the nature of this economy, sooner or later, David will come and chuck a stone at our forehead, mm-hmm, and we'll be lying in the dust. Mm-hmm. And that is one possibility, that what this new economy has is these kind of punctuated equilibria, where you'll see great concentration for a while, and then you'll see the incumbents trashed.
Investment is obviously something that is at the very heart of your book, and a hugely important thing in the economy. When people worry about the state of the economy, the state of capitalism today, often what is pointed out is that firms are making more and more money, especially these when the real winners of the economy, making more and more money, and yet not investing as much as they could be back into that business. So, you know, what is the kind of intangibles, Steen Westlake, capitalism without capital kind of take on that dynamic?
So, I think there's a couple of levels to this. There's been quite a lot of recent attention paid to the idea of, that markups are rising. And what economists mean by markups is effectively profit, the kind of the cost of doing a business taken away from the revenues you owe. And there's been some work where people have said, goodness me, markups have risen very sharply over the last 30 or 40 years. And the implication is, well, how can businesses make these sort of these apparently excessive profits? That must have happened because something's gone wrong with competition. And for example, there was a very interesting piece by Liam Halligan in The Telegraph not so long ago, saying this is a problem, and what we need to do is we need to put our foot back on the pedal of competition policy. Now, I think intangibles, the importance of intangibles, complicates that story quite a bit. The first reason is, if you look really carefully into this data of supposedly rising markups, it turns out that for the most part, the markups don't take into account intangible investment. So the money that firms spend on R&D, on branding, on organizational development, on commissioning the next Harry Potter script, on these kind of things, is actually not accounted for in those markups. And if you take those, what accountants would call SG&A, sales and general administrative expenses, but it includes all of that, if you take those out, markups have stayed much flatter over the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. So actually what you're seeing is a change in the cost that businesses incur from the traditional cost of goods sold, you know, the labour and machinery cost that goes into your mobile phone or whatever, to these intangibles like R&D, like marketing expenses. So that's just a kind of change from a less advanced to a more advanced economy. So partly part of this problem goes away. But it also means that to the extent we're worried about competition, to the extent we're worried about the gap between the leader and laggard firms, it might not be because our competition authorities have suddenly got lazy or sluggish. And I think if you look at what's been going on in competition authorities, whether it's in the UK or the EU or the US, if anything, they've got more assiduous over the years. Competition policy is taken pretty seriously. If you ask any economist, they think competition policy is really important. So it's not that they're doing a worse job. It's that because of the structure of the economy, that job has got much harder.
Right.
And I think if you're a policymaker, that's a bigger challenge. Because if you used to do something well, but now you don't do it well, it's really easy to just stop being such an idiot and you get it right again. Mm-hmm. If actually you're doing as well as you ever were, but the job has got much harder, that's a much bigger challenge.
Just more generally for business, for investors, for other people, how does this change the way they should think about the economy? How does this change the way they should kind of make decisions, whether it's about a company or a given investment or borrowing money to invest, or, you know, lots of these decisions?
Well, let's talk a little bit about investing in companies first. Mm-hmm. Of all, what does this mean if you own stocks and shares, if you're interested in financial markets? One thing that we know is that over time, because of the rise of intangibles, it's become much harder to understand the value of a company based just on its financial accounts. And there's been some fascinating analysis done looking at how much of a company's stock price can you calculate based on its P&L and its balance sheet, and how's that changed over time. If you go back to the 1950s or the 1960s, when intangible investment was quite low, actually the accounts are pretty informative. You know, there was still a job to be a stock picker, but fundamental analysis told you quite a lot.
Mm.
If you look at companies that were incorporated, or public companies that were incorporated in the last 20 years, the explanatory power of the accounts, in statistical terms, the R-squared, has significantly gone down. And actually, what the financial accounts prepare for you is almost totally uninformative. Mm. And that's partly because intangible assets, for the most part, aren't on company balance sheets. They just, accounting standards don't report them. They just go straight through the P&L like smoke. But also because, to come back to the four S's, because the value is so dependent on synergies, because the spillovers, meaning it's hard to pin down, you need to understand the intangibles in much more granular detail.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting, if you talk to equity analysts, who work in big, tangible capital-intensive industries like the postal services right. industry or something like that.
Or mines. Yeah, yeah.
They will be doing a lot of... They will care a lot about balance sheets and so forth. If you look at people who work in industries like pharmaceuticals, and pharma has always been an intangible-intensive mm-hmm. sector. It's just more and more the economy is becoming like pharma. Mm-hmm. Those guys will be looking at individual drug pipelines and valuing them very much based on kind of intelligence that you typically won't find much of in the company accounts.
Mm. Does that mean from an investment point of view, if you're just a sort of investor in a wide range of industries, you sort of at a disadvantage today in a way you weren't before because yeah. you don't... It requires more sort of... You need to know about whether...
Yeah.
This gym's marketing strategy is going to be effective, and that's not particularly easy to know unless you know gyms very well.
Well, in some ways, this is a great time to be a stock picker. This means that, you know, if you genuinely do have privileged insight into what's going on in a company, if you can do that analysis, that's unusually valuable, and you're more likely to kind of find alpha, to find additional return. And certainly, one of the things that we know that financial economic research has shown is that companies that have concentrated investors, so that have a number of what are called large block holders, people who own like a big chunk of shares mm-hmm. in a public company, interestingly, they are more likely to do R&D than companies with more distributed shareholders. And this ties back to what we are saying, because it turns out that because it's difficult to evaluate intangibles like R&D, if your attention is in 101 places, if you own shares in 10,000 companies, you have very little time to understand what's going on in company A or company B. But if you're a block holder, if you've got a large position, then you really can get under the skin and understand what's going on there. And that means, in turn, that you're much more likely, if you control aspects of the board of directors, if you're an influential activist shareholder, to be willing to approve management plans for investment in R&D because you know which the good projects are. Whereas if you're a diversified shareholder, what do you know? You may as well just go on the quarterly earnings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an interesting thing there that actually concentrated ownership, which a lot of aspects of our financial regulatory system discourage, is more important in an age of intangibles. And if you want to look at the kind of extreme version of that, the businesses or the sector which is all about highly scalable intangibles is obviously the sort of tech startup, the digital tech startup sector. And if you look at what's the preferred mode of capital for companies like that, it's, of course, venture capital. And venture capital is exactly
it's all about that.
Concentrated investment, yeah. privileged information, and high-touch activist investment.
And going back to the sort of policy-making side of things, and let's just, to finish up, let's just bring things to Britain specifically. Britain, obviously, I think you mentioned earlier, we're sort of further along the curve of intangible on the intangible curve than lots of places, and we have a big service service-based economy. What's the right way to think about that? Is the right way to think about that? Great, we are at the forefront of a change in economics, therefore we can sort of set the terms of it in ways other countries won't. Or is it a way to think of it that, gosh, all these terrible things that Stian writes about to do with inequality are just going to be so much worse here, and we're just more screwed than Germany or wherever.
I think, you know, this is a long-term trend that's happening everywhere. Mm. So everyone will... These problems become more and more important mm-hmm. to every country over time. I think there are some advantages for countries that get with the program quickly and that kind of adapt themselves to the intangible economy. And I think if we look at some countries that have done that really well, countries like Ireland, countries like Singapore, have actually adapted themselves pretty effectively to an intangible economy. I think a lot of people think of Ireland's economic success as being very much driven by low corporation tax, but there's a lot more to it than that. Ireland has been very effective as a home for intellectual property. They've built a lot of the kind of skills that you need for an intangible intensive economy. And they've utilised a lot of their inherent advantages, whether that's sort of historical links with the US, distribution channels into Europe, to take advantage of those kind of things. So I think the first question is, how do you make the most of this kind of thing? And the sort of classic example of that would be, let's go back to this question of the fact that the intangible economy tends to happen in particular places. If you look at places like Oxford or Cambridge or even London, places that are very, very intangible intensive, you'd want to let those places grow. So this would be an even the cost of the kind of planning restrictions that we have in the UK around those places, the cost of those restrictions will go up over time as the economy becomes more intangible intensive.
Right.
So it's a democratic choice, but people should know
but a bad
the
one.
Cost. People should know the cost.
Is it your view that lots of the, if you go to the common things that are wrong with Britain economically are to do with productivity, underinvestment, these sorts of things. Part of the story, I take it then, is that we are, because we can't measure these things very well when they're intangibles and services and so on, maybe things aren't quite as bad as people think.
I think some of this kind of very familiar story that Britain underinvests is somewhat mitigated by intangibles. So if you, Jonathan and I worked out, if you feature in intangible investment, this kind of long worried about gap between the UK economy and say the German economy somewhat closes. So that's good news. Having said that, if you think about, so R&D is clearly an important category of intangible assets. It's about, you know, a tenth of intangible investments. R&D is something where we do lag behind many other rich countries, which is one of the reasons why the government is working to try and encourage more R&D to create a better climate for research and development. So I think there are things that we can do. The awareness of the intangible economy in some senses maybe mitigates some of the things we're worried about, but it's certainly a challenge that the UK should be tackling head on.
Okay, Stian Westlake, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Stian Westlake on Capitalism Without Capital. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.